All three of Paul's so-called missionary journeys started in Antioch. Why were the believers in this city so supportive of these missionary endeavors? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Paul Dibdall from the School of Theology at Walla Walla University, and I'm the host and study guide author of this 13-week series centered on the Book of Acts. Today, our lesson is entitled Paul's First Missionary Journey. And our discussion will focus primarily on Acts chapters 13 and 14. My conversation partners are two New Testament scholars and colleagues of mine in the School of Theology, Brant Berglund and Carl Kosart. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
So, back to that question, Antioch. This seems to become a kind of center of Gentile Christianity, is that right to say? And maybe we should ask ourselves about that word Christianity even. So let me take that question first. Acts tells us that the believers were first called Christians in Antioch. Tell me about this word Christian and maybe the context where
well, we
this,
know that,
this
we
title
know, we know
come.
The early followers of Jesus were usually referred to as followers of the way or followers of Jesus. But here in this Gentile community located several hundreds of miles north of Jerusalem, Antioch, a cosmopolitan city of, we think, 500,000 people, probably the second or third largest city in the Roman Empire after Rome. It is the gateway between East and West. And here it's in this community of all kinds of people that the work of Saul of Tarsus is productive for the gospel. And that's a fascinating connection because we're told in Acts 11:19 that it's because of those who were scattered because of the persecution. These are Jewish, Greek-speaking Jews who have fled there, and they have an influence that people respond. And so in this Gentile community, to answer your question, they see the followers of the way, the followers of Jesus, that they are so like him, they start calling them Christians, followers of the Christ. They're like their little Christ, so to speak. And what an honor to be recognized as a follower of Christ, so they would call you Christians. It's a fascinating story.
I have a question, maybe kind of a pushback a little bit. I've heard, read, and this isn't my area of specialty, but that this term initially may have been a kind of pejorative term, that they were making fun of them in some way. I'm curious as to whether possible or plausible or
certainly plausible, and that to me is still they're belittle them, making fun of them, but there's a connection, right?
The point remains,
the point, they're still they recognize Christ. Yeah. They're so captivated with this Christ, right? So you know, whether we look at it as a pejorative term or a term of honor, I don't think it's a term of honor in that sense, but that they would still be associated with that.
Yeah.
I mean, boy, let my life be like that, that people would hound me, you know, give me a difficult time because
if they're going to make fun of me, let them make fun of me about the point that really matters,
exactly,
right?
Yeah.
Rather than some other less important
And yet,
aspect.
Even the belittling is so consistent with the life of Jesus, too, because Paul tells the Corinthian believers, you know, we preach Christ crucified. He's a stumbling block to the Jews, and it's foolishness to the Gentiles. Mm-hmm. We're just partaking in that when we're belittled for our faith, when we're called Christians. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's in Antioch. Antioch becomes kind of the basis for Paul's missionary journeys. And in this first, the sending out for this first missionary journey, we find that the group is gathered together fasting. It's a time of corporate fasting. And this is not a key point in the narrative, but I just want to highlight this for a second and ask you about that. Why is it that we don't seem, at least in the Western church, at least in the denomination that I'm most familiar with, my own denomination, Seventh-day Adventism, we don't talk a lot about fasting together, abstaining from food for spiritual purposes together. Either of you want to reflect at all on that? Why is it that fasting, which Jesus did, which the Bible greats seem to do, the early church, this isn't even the first occasion we read this, they fasted apparently quite regularly. We don't. Why?
I think culturally we value food and we value maybe material things in ways that we have some lessons to learn. But there are certainly enough biblical examples, both Old Testament and New. Jesus suggests that there's a time when his disciples would fast. They weren't doing it, interestingly enough, while Jesus was present with them. Jesus' disciples were questioned, why do John's disciples and the Pharisees fast and Jesus, your disciples, don't? And Jesus rebukes them for their statement and says, you fast when the bridegroom is here. No, you fast when the bridegroom is gone. While the bridegroom is here, there's celebration. But perhaps we have things to learn about this. Mm-hmm. My family has practiced fasting on maybe some rare occasions mm-hmm. that have gone longer than one meal or a day, but they're usually over times when something significant is happening mm-hmm. in our life and we are seeking the Lord in a special way.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, in the asking of the question, I'm obviously highlighting something that is somehow mm-hmm. significant to me, probably, and that's in fact the case. Not that I am a big faster, but the last thing you said, Brent, has been true for us. Those times when I'm thinking especially of my wife and I, when Kristen and I have fasted together, it's been when we were facing an issue, a significant issue, where we really wanted God's guidance, where we really didn't know what we ought to do. And those have been not necessarily easy times, but those have been times where we have, looking back, we can sense indeed that God did guide and God did bless. And I guess I would just hope, this is the little sermon here, I would hope that we might be open to the possibility that God might call us to seek him with prayer and fasting. Certainly there are dangers associated with this, and I don't think someone should just decide, well, I'm going to not eat and I'll call that fasting. I think there's reading and study that we should do. But I think this is a neglected aspect of the spiritual life that we find in the New Testament, but somehow hasn't really translated to us today, to our detriment, I think.
And I would suggest for some, before you fast, please go speak with your doctor. I think I hate it that we even have to say that, but there certainly you ought to find out if you are able to physically do that first.
And you're touching, of course, on some of the potential dangers associated with fasting physically or emotionally. I think we need to have healthy psychological kinds of relationship with food before we would engage in fasting.
So. Paul, I think one of the things, too, we often miss in these chapters, because there's so many details, right? It's easy to lose sight of them, is that there is approximately 12 years that have gone by since the stoning of Stephen, since the conversion of Saul. And usually we tend to think of Saul, Paul, the Apostle Paul, as this kind of instant transformation, mm-hmm. and he's off, right? But in reality, he, we're told, spent 3 years, right, in Arabia, comes back in Acts chapter 9. The apostles say, go back home to Tarsus. And then there's another 9 years that go by. And so he just disappears until Barnabas mm-hmm. remembers him mm-hmm. and invites him to come, and Paul becomes the associate pastor in Antioch.
Yeah.
So there's a time and a place for growing, mm-hmm. maturity, in order to be prepared for the greater work that God has for us.
Yeah. I think of the silent years of Jesus, mm-hmm. Son of God, miraculous, amazing birth, and then we don't hear much at all for 30 years, except for the one brief story when Jesus is 12. So there's those silent years of preparation, I think, and we have something like that here with Paul as well. Not just continual bright lights of publicity and preaching, but there's time for spiritual growth, development, and some of those things happen best outside of the spotlight.
I remember when I was a young theology major, someone asked the question, is it really time for school? Just go out there and preach the word. And I'm so grateful that I didn't listen to them because through education, God has given me a depth that I think can be used longer and in a broader ministry. Mm.
It brings a steadiness too, that time and learning some of the fruits of the Spirit, learning patience. I guess I don't think of Paul when I read his letters as maybe the most patient of people mm-hmm. sometimes, but I'm sure there were lessons God was teaching him.
So now a very general question, and we don't even have a lot of time left, but what should we say about Paul's first missionary journey? What are the highlights? What are the lessons? Where does he go? And I know both of you gentlemen, not trying to puff you up here, but you could talk at length about this. So give us the cream, all right, in the next 4 minutes.
Let me point out at the beginning, in verses 2 and 4, there's two important things. The first is that Paul and Barnabas are sent out by the church for a specific mission, and they have hands laid on them, and that is for a specific work. When that work is done, they come back, and then they're sent out again. But also, they are sent out not just by the church. They're sent out by the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit is directing it, and he directs it through the body, through the church. So there is a sense in which the laying on of hands is an affirmation for them to go in the Spirit's power.
And again, also, I mean, it's just, we can get caught up with this one verse, but how does the Holy Spirit speak to them, right? The Holy Spirit said, right, set apart for me Barnabas and Saul. Notice Barnabas comes first. Yeah. He's the important one in this case, but did they hear an audible voice? Was this just a conviction? Look what happened here. This could happen someplace else. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the questions I'm looking forward to having answered in the world made new.
Anything else from the first missionary journey? How far does Paul travel?
Paul travels the first journey. This is a couple thousand miles. I mean, it's just the distance being traveled. I know he does 2,300 miles on the second and third, so this is shorter than that. Yeah. But he's gone for, you know, 1 to 2 years. And I like to think of them on the shores of Antioch there down at the port, all their hopes and dreams, not realizing that they would also receive challenging circumstances.
Mistreatment.
Being mistreated, being beaten, being left for dead. Yet certainly even beyond that, they were still committed to the process of preaching the good news of Jesus. Mm-hmm.
And the journey, you know, we think about a trip to Cyprus on a boat. This is not a steamship. This is not a cruise ship. This is a small, perhaps a trireme sort of vessel, and dangerous travel.
I think I'll close, and it just seems almost criminal to end because there's so much that we have left unsaid here. But I think I'll close with a quote from Acts chapter 14. It's really kind of a comical story in some ways, where Paul and Barnabas, the locals, the pagans there, think that they are Zeus and Hermes. There's a backstory to that, but they believe that the gods have come to them in human form. And Paul assures them that that's not the case. They're only human. But then he gives this wonderful wonderful talk where he talks about God's grace and mercy extended towards them, these pagans. And he says, God has shown kindness to you. He's provided you with food. And he says that God is the one who fills your hearts with joy. Mm-hmm. And this is meaningful to me. Sometimes we emphasize, well, if you don't know and worship God, then you're separated and you can't experience good in life or joy in life. And here we have a different message. Even though you don't know the Creator God, He has still been kind to you, and He still gives you joy. This is a great God indeed. Thank you, Carl and Brant, for your contributions. A special thanks also to Abby Wissink, our program engineer. And finally, thank you for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Paul Dibdahl.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.